blind, have low vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Janice Marie Hunt, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the Sunday, November 30th, 2025 issue of the New York Times business section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. What can I help you with? The company has made its chat box safer, but can it also appeal to more people? A book that criticized Silicon Valley gets dusted off. Even Silicon Valley disliked Silicon Valley. More than two-thirds of residents agreed in a 2024 poll that the tech companies have partly or completely misplaced their moral compass. And that was before so many in tech embraced the Trump administration. Some of those who believe tech lost its way are finding explanations in a book published a quarter century ago. Paulina Borsuk's Cyber Selfish saw the seeds of disaster in the late 1990s dot-com boom, which she argued transformed a community that was previously sober, civic-minded, and egalitarian into something toxic. Silicon Valley, Ms. Borsuk wrote, hated governments, rules, and regulations. It believed if you were rich, you were smart. It thought people could be, and indeed should be, programmed just like a computer. Techno-libertarianism, as she labeled it, had no time for the messy realities of being human. At the time, Silicon Valley was just a bunch of young people boasting and hyping. But Ms. Borsuk predicted that when the tech world had amassed sufficient money and power, it would start imposing its beliefs on everyone outside the valley. If empathy has now become a distasteful personal failing, if surveillance capitalism has become the default shrugged-off business practice, if the environmental impacts of AI are waved away, then we are, alas, living in a tech-driven culture. I saw headed our way 30 years ago, Ms. Borsuk said in an interview. It's terrible that I was right. Her prescience did her no favors. Cyber Selfish, published in 2000, was such a setback to her career that she refers to it as TDB. That damn book. She never wrote another. She spent years as an Airbnb superhost in exchange for free rent. Now at 71 and in poor health, she lives a precarious life in the East Bay of San Francisco, dependent on a GoFundMe that friends set up. Her revival began in May with Jonathan Sanhu's radical political criticism site, Fake Soap. She was too right, too early, and too unwilling to flatter the cathedral of code, Mr. Sanhu said. It accelerated recently with The Nerd Reich, a podcast by Gil Duran, a former spokesman for several California politicians. His talk with Ms. Borsuk garnered over 120,000 views on YouTube in 3 weeks. Ms. Borsuk's champions are celebrating her on social media. I was quoting Paulina Borsuk before it was cool. The speculative fiction writer Charlie Jan Anders bragged, Cyber Selfish has been out of print forever, but the secondhand copies have all been scooped up. Amazon does not have any. Even libraries say they don't have it. Would-be readers have placed no notices on X to no avail. International publishers are asking Ms. Borsig about republishing it. Ms. Borsig's comeback arrives at a moment of soul-searching for some of the Silicon Valley writers who have charted its rise to power over the decades. How did the glorious dreams of liberation through technology immortalize in Apple's ad asserting that the company would save us from 1984 morph into the current landscape of trillion-dollar companies flexing control over everyone's life? I thought. I knew Silicon Valley. I was wrong. I was wrong was the headline on Stephen Levy's September feature in Wired magazine. Mr. Levy, like Ms. Borsig, had been around the Valley forever, but his reporting generally reflected and sometimes celebrated the view from the executive suites. Now, those executives are behaving in unexpected ways. Mr. Levy noted, for instance, that Apple's chief executive Tim Cook presented President Trump in August with a special engraved statue, which the writer called the most dubious, most obscure product in the company's near half century. Mr. Levy wrote, "Here's something that took me by surprise. How quickly and decisively the visionaries, aligned themselves with Trump, a man whose values violently clashed with the egalitarian impulses of the digital revolution. How did I miss that? The techno-libertarian ethos. The mid-1990s was an era of great hope for the freedom that computers would inevitably bring. John Perry Barlow, a one-time lyricist for the Grateful Dead, wrote a Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace. It was addressed to governments and those who believed in traditional governments. On behalf of the future, I ask you of the past to leave us alone. The Declaration stated, you are not welcome among us. You have no sovereignty where we gather. We are creating a world where anyone, anywhere, may express his or her beliefs, no matter how singular, without fear of being coerced into silence or conformity. Ms. Borsig found the hatred of government puzzling. No one has benefited more and suffered less from the government than the inhabitants of Silicon Valley, Ms. Borsig said. I always wondered, why are they so mad? Much of cyber selfish traces the roots of a budding techno-libertarian ethos among the tech elite, a philosophy that scorned the greater good in favor of the bottom line. The notion that because one is rich, one must be smart, however fallacious, is deeply embedded. People can't equate piles of money or the promise of it with good sense, wisdom, and savoir faire, she wrote. Ms. Borsig saw things differently from her Buddhist colleagues for two reasons. One, she had deep experience in Silicon Valley, so knew the technology that was celebrated. And two, she experienced a personal tragedy. She grew up in Pasadena, the heart of the Southern California 1960s engineering culture that made the moonshots and the internet possible. When she was 14, a friend shot her with a Colt 45, a horrendous accident that left her with a traumatic brain injury. Wow. There was no way I could have gone to law school, medical school, public policy school, become a genealogist, gotten an MBA, learned a foreign language. In some ways, I remain cognitive as I was at age 14. Ms. Borsig wrote in an autobiographical essay, she had a hard time processing information in an academic format. So she drifted into the world of computers. She worked at Data Communications Magazine, covering the 1984 news conference where Bill Gates introduced Microsoft Windows to the world. Her view of tech was practical, the way many engineers thought at the time. It was just like indoor plumbing or electricity, infrastructure, not magic. I would never argue that technology hasn't done some good things, she said in an interview at a Mexican restaurant near her apartment on a recent rainy East Bay afternoon. I just don't see why this toxic ideology had to accompany it. These are tools. I mean, modern dentistry is great, but your dentist doesn't insist you worship him. Exactly. In 1993, a new San Francisco publication called Wired began publishing. The digital revolution is whipping through our lives like a Bengali typhoon. While the mainstream media is still groping for the snooze button, a co-founder, Louis Rosetto, wrote in the first issue, Ms. Borsig was among Wired's earliest and most prolific contributors. She was also one of the new women. Wired was one of those publications that come along at the right moment, like Rolling Stones in the late 1960s or Playboy in the 1950s, creating as well as covering an emerging way of life. In Wired's case, it embraced technology as culture. The magazine made geeks sexy, which in turn made Wired hot. The geeks were creating the future that Wired wanted. By the end of the decade, Wired editors had developed a list of hot stocks that were sure to capitalize on the tech boom and license the magazine's name to a real-life fund that investing in the companies. It was all too cozy for Mr. Borsig. I couldn't entirely get with the program, nor keep my mouth shut about it, she wrote in Cyber Selfish. Cyber Selfish was dropped by its first publisher, then picked up by a second for less money. It was published yet as the dot-com boom began to unravel. It got some good news. The New York Times critic called it smart, funny, irreverent, but it didn't sell and it didn't lead to anything. It flatlined me in the cultural sense, in the cultural universe. Ms. Borsig said, Kevin Kelly, the executive editor of Wired from its founding until 1999, said he only vaguely recalled Cyber Selfish. He rejected Ms. Borsig's notion, made at length in the book, that the magazine validated and encouraged the more unsavory aspects of the tech industry. Truth and reconciliation. Ms. Borsig's friend remembered hard times. Paulina saw the dark lining in every silver cloud and insisted on her own intuitions. She followed her muse, Rather Than Money, called Jeff Ubels. A former entrepreneur, there wasn't much market demand for pessimism and foreboding in San Francisco. She wasn't the only critic of Silicon Valley. Clifford Stoll, an astronomer and writer, wrote Silicon Snake Oil, Second Thoughts on the Information Highway, in 1995, saying the internet would never be anything more than a toy. Interesting. The book's predictions garnered a lot of attention. No online database will replace your daily newspapers, he wrote. In 2010, with newspapers reeling, Mr. Stoll renounced his own book, Wrong. Yep, he said in an online forum. In 2025, living not far from Ms. Borsig in the East Bay, Mr. Stoll has changed his mind yet again. Only a fool believes that technology is a cornucopia of wonderful stuff without a price to be paid, he said in an interview. Even Wired, for so long a booster, has become increasingly Borsukian. It now reports aggressively on Silicon Valley. A recent video has the U.S. becomes a surveillance state. Even Wired, for so long a booster, has become increasingly Borsukian. It now reports aggressively on Silicon Valley. A recent video has the U.S. become a surveillance state? Has it become a surveillance state? Hope it works out, Mr. Borsig said of the magazine newfound fervor. Her own attitudes have remained remarkably consistent. New York rhetoric came along, she noted in a 2015 Cyber Selfish update, but the political impulses always remain the same. I still believe in regulation and that there is such a thing as the public good, and don't believe the market can or should provide everything, she wrote. She added that the vast amount of money generated by the valley where is always at the root of the problem. Money is power. So what is to be done? In the new issue of Information, a very irregular tech magazine with the slogan "Everyday computers are making people easier to commuters." Easier to use, too. Ms. Borsig proposes a Silicon Valley Truth and Reconciliation Commission. She imagines testimony from a long list of tech journalists turned investors, as well as reporters turned celebrants. Also, confessions from the men who came up with the label sharing economy, disruptive innovation, and thought leader. The proceedings would at the least clear the air and provide greater understanding. Her editor asks, "Is this humor or is this serious?" Ms. Brooks answered, "I don't know." You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times business section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. 42%, the share of shoppers using AI tools for holiday shopping. For inspiration on what gifts to buy loved ones, many people are turning to artificial intelligence tools. About 42% of consumers are using AI shopping aids, many of them younger shoppers, according to a survey of more than 4,000 consumers that Harris Poll conducted for MasterCard. Some AI features offer customer ways to check prices, see if items are in stock, and get gift suggestions. Target, Walmart, and Ralph Lauren are among the retailers rolling out chatbots to guide customers through shopping queries and customer reviews. OpenAI released an instant checkout feature on ChatGPT that allows people to buy items from certain stores without leaving the chat. The tools are meant to help guide overwhelmed shoppers through decisions and deals. Though some consumers said the chat box offered too few products, while others report that they were given an overwhelming amount of options. Autonomous shopping, where AI agents truly understand you, find the perfect gift, and orchestrate the entire purchase journey, isn't quite here yet for this holiday season. Tyler Murray, the Chief Enterprise Solutions Officer of Commerce and Technology at VML, a marketing agency, told Natalie Roach and Kathleen Rode of the New York Times. Consumers are likely to spend big this year, despite tariff pressures, inflation, and general economic uncertainty. The National Retail Federation, a trade group, has predicted that holiday spending would reach $1.2 trillion this year, up from $976.1 billion last year. Wow. Deloitte has also forecast that retail sales will top $1 trillion this year. AI shopping tools, despite their imperfections so far, may still prove a convenient helper and scapegoat. James Wilsterman, a tech executive in San Francisco who doesn't like shopping, told The Times that if his family disliked his gifts, I'll blame it on ChatGPT. Take a peek into their holiday windows. Two retail chiefs take stock of a make-or-break shopping season at a time of tariffs, a tough economy, and a fight for relevance. They're putting lots of hope in Jellycats. Department stores may not be as important as they core once were, but they still really take center stage at one point in the year, the Christmas shopping season. They conjure memories of visits to Santa ornate window display and Mariah Carey melodically describing all she wants for Christmas. Steep discounts also sweeten the season for deal-seeking shoppers. This year has been particularly challenging for the retail industry, with tariffs and inflation hitting consumer confidence. Promoting the holiday spirit and prompting more sales during a make-or-break period for retailers has become even more crucial for leaders of department stores looking to end a tough year on a high. Nobody has to spend money, right? Said Andre Mater, chief executive of Selfridge, the London-based department store group. You only spend the money when the sentiment and the atmosphere is ripe to it. On the other side of the Atlantic, Pete Nordstrom, who runs the Nordstrom retail chain as co-chief executive with his brother Eric, also emphasizes getting the right energy in stores. Mr. Nordstrom, 63, is a great-grandson of the founder of the company, which opened its first store in 1901 in Seattle. Mr. Mander, 66, led various retailers in Europe before joining Selfridges, whose flagship London store opened in 1909. The industry veterans represent their countries on a council of department store chiefs and regularly trade notes and study each other's strategies, customizing them for their target shoppers, who have a wide array of choices beyond the traditional department store. This joint interview, conducted virtually with Mr. Nordstrom in Seattle and Mr. Mader in London, has been edited and condensed. The holiday shopping season is often associated with department stores. How is what you are doing in your stores right now connected to the state of the economy? Pete Nordstrom, everything is tied to customer sentiment, which is largely informed by the economy. If you're buying for 7, 8, 9 people, you've got to figure out how to do that. That creates a lot of stress for customers. We're trying to take that stress out, make it fun for people. You could come to Nordstrom for something that feels charming and interesting, and that's just phoning it in. But it doesn't have to be expensive. Andre Mader, I just want to mention Jellycat. It's one of the hottest gifts in the world, and everything in Jellycat is under £100 or dollars. Nordstrom, we get asked all the time about the differences of what sells regionally. Jellycat is a hot item for us too, whether you're in the UK or the US. The best items are really the best items. Mader, I was in the store an hour ago where a few people were waiting in the queue for Jellycats for 45 minutes. Let's talk more about the state of the consumer. What are you seeing? Mader says, we are living in a very turbulent time. I'm sure everything that's happening in the world is impacting the consumer's spend. It's impacting their sentiment. I also believe we've seen a slight light in the tunnel in the last few months. It was quite difficult in the middle of the year. With the start of the autumn trade, we've seen slightly different behavior. However, consumers are spending less by average ticket. What are shoppers pulling back on? Mader, the category still struggling the most is luxury accessories, but glasses and sunglasses are doing extremely well. I believe this is a substitute category for buying a luxury brand. You still have something from Chanel or Dior or another important brand rather than a very expensive purchase. Pete, what are you seeing? Nordstrom replies, it has been healthy all year for us. Sometimes that flies in the face of what you might think is happening because, to Andre's point, it's a turbulent economy. The macro factors that we don't have control over are not always great. How are tariffs affecting your companies? Nordstrom. It puts a lot of pressure on everyone because, let's check this out, those costs are real and they get passed along. This idea that someone just absorbs those costs and they don't become a thing and prices don't go up, it's just not true. Not true at all. Not in our industry. The margins are too thin. Mader, same for us. Nordstrom, I applaud our vendor partners. They've been thoughtful about it, but at the end of the day, those costs get passed along and that has an impact on demand, no doubt about it. So how did you approach pricing this year? Are you nervous that people will balk at higher prices? Nordstrom, yes, of course. Price is a key factor in any purchasing decision. We are not agile enough to change everything in a week or two or a month's notice around pricing. If we're sourcing things from a certain country and then all of a sudden that tariff goes up, we can't just respond in 2 weeks and buy it from somewhere else. Our suppliers can't move that fast. Mater. This is the business of our merchant teams to make sure we have a curated situation, not only in color and style and fashion, but also in price. Tourists can be big business for high-end department stores. What are you seeing there? Are you getting fewer tourists from, say, China? It started quite tough with international sales. It was much better the last 3 months. By far, our number one increase is from the United States. We are around a 20% increase in that customer. China is still tough. We see a little bit of recovery over the last 8 weeks, but it's not the figures we had before the pandemic. Very similar for the Middle East. How do you explain the increase of American shoppers at Selfridges? Mater says, it's a mix. I think Europe is sexy. London is sexy. I'm not sure everybody's doing as well with Americans as Selfridges. I believe it's the attraction of our store. So Pete, is the stealing your customers? Nordstrom. Particularly in places like New York, customers have a ton of choices. They're sophisticated. They travel, they can buy things online. But the large majority of the business is with people that live near the stores. You both clearly love retail. What were your first jobs in the industry? Nordstrom. I started in the stock room because I wasn't old enough to sell. Then when I was old enough to sell, I sold women's shoes. Mater. I was 16 and started my retail career in an apprenticeship in Bern, Switzerland. I have spent 50 years in retail and most of the time on the shop floor. What did your time in the shoe department teach you, Pete? It was a lesson in humility because it's a hard job. I've never worn these shoes. I am not a woman. I had to have some level of authority and knowledge at a time in your life when you don't have a lot of confidence and authority. You learn a lot of lessons that you carry with no forever. Mater, everybody who is in top management of a retail or department store should have been at least in some function on the shop floor. Otherwise, you never understand retail. In Nordstrom's New York store, you just remodeled the corner pop-up section for gifting. Was that inspired by Selfridges' corner shop concert? Nordstrom, yes. Not just them, but yes. Great, brilliant. Right before we opened in New York, one of the things that my brothers and I did is we spent a lot of time looking for the best stores in the world. And Selfridges is the very top of that list. We would be out of business if we didn't learn every day. Nordstrom is number one in services. You do a lot of things very well, but you are world famous for how you treat customers. That's one thing everybody can learn from Nordstrom. If you're dressing up, for a holiday party, what's your favorite article of clothing or accessories? Again, if you're dressing up for a holiday party, what's your favorite article of clothing or accessories? Mater, I'm very famous for two things, for a colored handkerchief and for colored socks. They don't have to match, but they need to be in color. Nordstrom, a jacket or a coat or something like that. That's probably the thing that I put the most thought into. Would your source ever accept cryptocurrency? We don't do it today, but you never know what's coming in the future, right? Nordstrom, we've got to meet customers where they are. If that's how they want to pay and it's a legitimate form of payment, we're going to figure out how to take it. We're not there right now, but I would never say never on that either. When you walk into one of your stores, what's the first thing you notice? Mater, for me, it's atmosphere. It's a smile from the staff, the smell in the air. I feel in a second if the store is successful or not. Nordstrom, because we've got this heritage in shoes, you can really tell by how a shoe department is going. If that's working well, it's such a barometer of service. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times business section of on the Niagara Frontier radio reading service. Tripping over an invisible red line. I was fired recently. The excuse was that I contributed to an uncomfortable work environment. My coworker, who is Latino and who I know is a legal citizen, had left the store to go to the warehouse and return in record time. I joked that he was so fast, it was like ice was running from him. To me, it was a joke. Whether in good taste or not, it's a different question. To him, it was a racist comment, which was certainly not the intention. I said something that a coworker found offensive, and the boss chose to dismiss me. I can't find fault with that. I live in an at-will state, and he has the legal right to do so. My issue was that I worked in an environment where there was no check on inappropriate speech among coworkers. I worked in a retail store. My boss made constant jokes that were racist, misogynist, homophobic, anti-Semitic. All the jokes were made in jest. And the staff, which consisted of African Americans, women, gays, and Jews, found it all very funny and gave back as much as they got. There's a handbook of what appropriate language in the office, but it also rarely applied and never cited. How can I be held responsible for going over the line when there is no line? I was playing by the rules, or lack of rules, that management created and then got penalized for doing so. I know it's legal, but is it fair? That's a great question. My first instinct here is to wonder if your description of your workplace is accurate. If your manager was known to crack constant racism, misogynist, homophobic, and anti-Semitic jokes, you and your coworkers might have felt pressure to accept and even return the banter, even if they disliked it. And even if there was an acceptable level of offensive repartee, the line you describe as non-existent may have been more plainly drawn for your coworkers. Perhaps it was something like, broad stereotypes are tolerant, but specific mention of horrifying event cuts too close to the bone, especially if interpredictable as a threat. Still, I can understand why you feel mistreated. You were frustrated by what legal philosophers would describe as the distinction between procedural fairness and substantive fairness. Was the procedure by which you were fired fair? As you know it, as you acknowledge it, it was. There was a handbook with clear instructions on allowable speech. You violated those instructions and you were fired in a manner compliant with state law. But was it substantially fair? Assuming your account of the situation is accurate, no, you were singled out and punished for behavior indistinguishable from that of your coworkers. Substantive fairness from an employer is a nice dream, but in many situations, especially absent a strong union with a good contract, you're lucky to even get procedural fairness. There are moral and ethical reasons not to crack racist jokes, but your situation reminds us of a practical one as well. You can't tell ahead of time where everyone's red line is. I am open to the possibility that everyone at your former workplace enjoyed the give and take and that the offensive humor served as a team building or morale boosting purpose. But offensive repartee is effectively a game in pushing people's buttons until they explode. Wow. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times business section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Returning a cherished home to happier days. F. Murray Abraham's wife of 60 years, Kate Hannon Abraham, died 3 years ago after a long illness. I didn't want to change anything in our apartment, Mr. Abraham, 86, said of his two-bedroom duplex in Manhattan. But our daughter kept saying, you've got to do the house over. I suppose she thought it should be brought back to life, and she was right. But it was a while before I could get to that point. Mr. Abraham, who stars with Kristen Chenoweth in the musical adaptation of The Queen of Versailles on Broadway, won an Academy Award in 1985 for his performance in the drama Amadeus. He also appeared in the movie Scarface, Mighty Aphrodite, and The Grand Budapest Hotel, as well as the television series Homeland, for which he received an Emmy nomination. But most significant, at least for his apartment, Mr. Abraham was a second season cast member of The White Lotus. During the show's extended shoot in Sicily, Mr. Abraham became close to the actor Michael Imperialia, who played his son, and to Imperialia's wife, Victoria, an interior designer, echoing his daughter. Miss Imperialia urged Mr. Abraham to redo the apartment, the family home since 1987. I said to him, let's return your home to the time when everything was happy and everyone was in good health. It took me almost a year to convince him. Finally, Mr. Abraham assented. He had to go to Latvia for a few months to shoot a movie, and he told her to renovate his apartment while he was gone. Victoria wanted to make the bedroom into a cave for me, a man cave, Mr. Abraham said. To that end, Miss Imperialia covered the walls in golden velvet. No one does that anymore, but Victoria did it for me, he added. It's really neat. When his wife was alive, Mr. Abraham kept the Marat maid paintings in his collaboration, all but Mr. Perilous, in the small office he owns on the ground floor of the building. Don loves women and I love women too, and these are very good paintings, by the way, he said. Now some have migrated home. His wife preferred Mr. Perilous' other pieces in the apartment, the portraits of her husband at work, including a rendering of him as the lawyer and fixer Roy Cohn in the Broadway production of Angels in America. This hanger was crocheted by his grandmother. I think it's important to keep those things around, Mr. Abraham said. Kate's grandmother raised her and taught her handiwork. I have just been flabbergasted that market measures of volatility have been so low up until recently. Kenneth Rogoff, a professor of economics at Harvard University on the heightened risk in the global economy and financial system. TikTok shop has really unique in how fast it develops into this behemoth marketplace. Alex, chief of executive officer of Charm.io, an e-commerce analytics company, this is not the outcome we had hoped for. After weight loss, drugs failed to slow the progression of Alzheimer's in 2 decades. Gifts for the Journey Ahead, Engineered for Life, Rimowa. Reporting on major events as they unfold. Elections, extreme weather, award ceremonies, sports championships. We provide live coverage of major events so readers can follow updates in real time. The New York Times. The New York Times Deal Book Summit, December 3rd, 2025, Jazz at Lincoln Center's Appeal Room. This December, the most consensual people of this moment sit down with Andrew Ross Sorkin for a day of unscripted, unguarded conversations. Don't miss a word. Thank you to our sponsors, Vanguard, U.S. Bank, Capital One, Invest Company, QQQ, University of Michigan, Accenture. Thank you to all of our sponsors. The chatbot wanted to chat, but some users that posed risk. This was controversial at the time. Nick Turley, the head of ChatGPT, left on using Matrix to trace a number of things, including how often people were using ChatGPT each hour, day, week, and month. OpenAI was not oriented toward taking those kinds of risks seriously. Tim Marple, who worked on OpenAI's intelligence and investigations team in 2024 on the potential for menopause and psychological harm to ChatGPT issues. The short users of the app Replica said they needed their chatbot champions for managing depression, anxiety, and suicidal tendencies. It sounds like a science fiction. A company turns a dial on a product used by hundreds of millions of people and inadvertently destabilizes some of their minds. But that is essentially what happened at OpenAI this year. One of the first signs came in March. Sam Altman, the chief executive, and other company leaders got an influx of puzzling emails from people who were having incredible conversations with ChatGPT. These people said the company's AI chatbot understood them as no person ever had and was shedding light on mysteries of the universe. Mr. Altman forwarded the messages to a few lieutenants and asked them to look into it. That got it on our radar as something we should be paying attention to in terms of this new behavior we haven't seen before, said Jason Kwan, OpenAI's chief strategy officer, it was a warning that something was wrong with the chatbot. For many people, ChatGPT was a better version of Google, able to answer any question under the sun in a comprehensive and human-like way. OpenAI was continually improving the chatbot's personality, memory, and intelligence. But a series of updates earlier this year that increased usage of ChatGPT made it different. The chatbot wanted to chat. It started acting like a friend and a confidant. It told users that it understood them, that their ideas were brilliant, and that it could assist them in whatever they wanted to achieve. It offered to help them talk to spirits or build a force field vest or plan a suicide. Ooh. The lucky ones were caught in its spell for just a few hours. For others, the effects lasted for weeks or months. OpenAI did not see the scale at which disturbing conversations were happening. Its investigations team was looking for problems like fraud, foreign influence operations, or, as required by law, child exploitation materials. The company was not yet searching through conversations for indications of self-harm or psychological distress. Creating a bewitching chatbot or any chatbot was not the original purpose of OpenAI. Founded in 2015 as a nonprofit and staffed with machine learning experts who care deeply about AI safety, it wanted to ensure that artificial general intelligence benefited humanity. In late 2022, a slapdash demonstration of an AI-powered assistant called ChatGPT captured the world's attention and transformed the company into a surprise tech juggernaut now valued at $500 billion. The 3 years since have been chaotic, exhilarating, and nerve-wracking for those who work at OpenAI. The board fired and rehired Mr. Altman, unprepared for selling a consumer product to millions of consumers. OpenAI rapidly hired thousands of people, many from tech giants that aim to keep users glued to a screen. Last month, it adopted a new for-profit structure. As the company was growing, its novel mind-bending technology started affecting users in unexpected ways. Now a company built around the concept of safe, beneficial AI faces five wrongful death lawsuits. Wow. To understand how this happened, the New York Times interviewed more than 40 current and former OpenAI employees, executives, safety engineers, researchers. Some of these people spoke with the company's approval and have been working to make ChatGPT safer. Others spoke on the condition of anonymity because they feared losing their job. OpenAI is under enormous pressure to justify its sky-high valuation and the billions of dollars it needs from investors for very expensive talent, computer chips, and data centers. When ChatGPT became the fastest-growing consumer product in history, with 800 million weekly users, it set off an AI boom that has put OpenAI into direct competition with tech behemoths like Google. Units, until its AI can accomplish some incredible feat, say generating a cure for cancer, success is partly defined by turning ChatGPT into a lucrative business. That means continually increasing how many people use and pay for it. Healthy engagement is how the company describes its aim. We are building ChatGPT to help users thrive and reach their goals, said Hannah Wong, OpenAI spokeswoman. We also pay attention to whether users return because that shows ChatGPT is useful enough to come back to. The company turned a dial this year that made usage go up. but with risk to some users. OpenAI is now seeking the optimal setting that will attract more users without sending them spiraling. Wow. OpenAI is letting users take control of the dial and hopes that will keep them coming back. That matrix still matters, maybe more than ever. In October, Mr. Turley, who runs ChatGPT, made an urgent announcement to all employees. He declared a code orange. OpenAI was facing the greatest competitive pressure we've ever seen, he wrote, according to four employees with access to OpenAI Slack. The new, safer version of the chatbot wasn't connecting with users, he said. The message linked to a memo with goals. One of them was to increase daily active users by 5% by the end of the year. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the Sunday, November 30, 2025 issue of the New York Times Business Section. Your reader has been Janice Marie Hunt. Thank you for listening.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have today's USA Today. Following that at 2 o'clock is episode number 4, Boat Baby by Vicky Nguyen. Stay with us for these readings and more.
The following program is